From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, a recording of a poltergeist and the late abductee Betty Hill. But here's what's happening. Hurricane Florence downgraded late Thursday to now a Category 1 storm as the North Carolina coast was battered by hurricane force winds and life-threatening storm surges. State officials are still bracing for the worst, but it has dropped dramatically. Let's keep up with our intention prayers. Maybe we can slow this down even more. Brett Jensen, of course, is a reporter for our affiliate WBT in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's in the thick of things right now. Brett, can you kind of describe the scene for us?
Yeah, right now it's the eye of the hurricane is still some 45 miles, 50 miles off the coast of Wilmington, North Carolina, and it's moving basically due west at this point. And the winds, sustained winds right now on the shore, we are about maybe 2 miles inland, and sustained winds right now consistently are right around 45, and we're getting gusts right up to about 65 right now, and it's been raining nonstop for about 12 hours now, and because it is a slow-moving hurricane, extremely slow, it's only moving at 5 miles an hour, which most hurricanes are triple and quadruple that. That's the problem that has everyone nervous here, and they think there's going to be minimum 20 inches of rain and up to 30 inches of rain if this just keeps at its current pace. And that's what's got everyone concerned, is about the rain.
Well, let's hope it just keeps dying down. But you're right, the slower a hurricane moves, the more water it brings in.
Correct. And, you know, and not only that, but then you have the more you have to deal with hurricane force winds. And, you know, that's the big thing right now is like, okay, yeah, the wind, but because it's so slow and moving, you also have the storm surge. And as we speak, high tide is hitting right now. And they're talking about up to 12, 13 feet of storm surge. And that's what really does most of the damage is the storm surge and then all the flooding that goes with it.
Thanks, Brett. Brett Jensen from our affiliate WBT in Charlotte, North Carolina. Keep up the intention prayers. Let's slow this thing down. Look, we're not going to get credit for it if we do stop it, but you know what? It's worth it. President Donald Trump accused Democrats of inflating the 3,000-person death count from last year's hurricanes in Puerto Rico in order to, quote, make me look bad, unquote. The accusation by Mr. Trump's latest attempt to defend his handling of natural disasters as Hurricane Florence bears down on the southeastern U.S. And a pair of tweets, here we go again, President Trump disputed an independent report commissioned by Puerto Rico's government that raised the death toll from Hurricane Maria to 2,975. Howard Bloom is with us. I asked him to work on this story for us. Howard, I have one quick question for you before we get to your report. They did come out with a report originally and said about 16-plus people had died from the hurricanes, and then they inflated it to 2,975. That's a huge jump. Why the disparity?
Well, it's a huge jump, but okay. So earlier today, Donald Trump, as you said, tweeted that 3,000 people did not die in the two hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico, and he threw out the figures of 6 to 18 deaths, and then he blamed the 3,000 figure on the Democrats. So the question is, are Trump's figures and his claims about a Democratic conspiracy against him correct? And you have to judge for yourself. Here are the basic facts. Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico a year ago on September 20th of 2017, and it was devastating. According to a Harvard University study of 3,299 homes, the average household surveyed went approximately 41 days without cell phone service, 68 days without water. 68 days without water.
Yeah, this was a Category 4 when it hit.
Right, and so they went 84 days without electricity in some of these homes. 30% of the surveyed households never got their electricity back during the course of the survey. And in fact, depending on what publication you look at, people either went for almost a year without electricity or are still going without electricity. So a Harvard press release on its mortality study points out that the problems have been particularly deadly for citizens with chronic illnesses. Now, I know that sort of illness, George. You know that I was in bed for 15 years with chronic fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalomyelitis. And that means I have to take 30 medications a day and an intramuscular injection every morning. And without those medications, I could well be dead. And there was no access to medications for many, many people. So living conditions have been inconceivably primitive for nearly a year, but how many Puerto Ricans have died because of the hurricane's wreckage of Puerto Rico's infrastructure, that lack of electricity, that lack of water? The first figure issued on the death toll of Hurricane Maria came from Puerto Rico's safety director, Hector M. Pesquera, who said at least 6 people had died. Later, the number was increased to 64. But Puerto Rico's governor is an MIT graduate and a biomedical engineer who once won an International Mathematical Olympiad. He's no dummy. So he wanted a scientific study to determine just how many people were killed by Hurricane Maria's destruction of infrastructure and disruption of medical services and by the bumbling, fumbling restoration of the island. The first study came in May 2018, 5 months after the storm. It was a collaboration between a highly credible team, the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and the Carlos Albizu University in Puerto Rico. They extrapolated the death rates within these 3,299 households to the entire Puerto Rican population, and the result was the study team estimated that there were 4,645 additional deaths in 2017 during the period following Hurricane Maria. Not 6, not 18, nearly 5,000. But there's a problem. This is an estimate. Figuring out the death toll from a disaster is a tricky proposition.
Oh, as we know, in earthquakes, let's say in Iran, the death toll always goes up.
Yeah, because you find people under a building. You find that people have drowned. You find that people have simply been crushed in their homes, and you knew nothing about it. So these figures have been published in extremely illustrious publications. The American Medical Association published one of these research studies. Another of the research studies was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. These are top journals. You have to be really good to get into them. Then, so we had another group of specialists that recently took a crack at estimating the total number of deaths due to the hurricane. The researchers came from the highly credible George Washington University Milken Institute School of Public Health and 5 institutions in Puerto Rico, including the Puerto Rican Bureau of Forensic Scientists. This George Washington University report was released at the end of August, and it cut the 4,645 of the Harvard study down to 2,975, which is a figure well above President Trump's right. 18. But this, too, was an estimate. It gathered data on Puerto Rico's normal mortality rate and extrapolated. So you and I have a choice. We accept the Trump figure, 18 deaths, or we accept figures based on months of meticulous research done by experts at Harvard, George Washington University, and in Puerto Rico, figures that, as you say, find what's happening in the aftermath, sometimes many weeks or months after the event itself.
I just got to tell you, Howard, I've never seen such bantering in all my life since this campaign, since he was elected. I mean, it's truly unbelievable. By the way, folks, just so everybody knows, people who live in Puerto Rico are U.S. citizens. Howard, thank you for that, and keep in touch. At least one person killed, 13 injured in Massachusetts after a bizarre series of gas explosions tore through several communities outside of Boston. At least 13 patients were taken to a hospital as a result of the gas fires triggered by a problem with a gas line that feeds homes in those communities north of Boston. Gas service was shut down by the company to roughly 8,000 customers. U.S. and Cuban officials met at the State Department to discuss the very mysterious health problems that affected more than 24 American embassy personnel, a situation that led to a reduction in staffing at the Havana mission and a chill in ties between the two nations. At least 26 Americans have been affected by a very mysterious illness at the U.S. embassy in Cuba, with symptoms that included hearing loss, tinnitus, ringing in the ears, vertigo, headaches, fatigue, and a pattern consistent with mild traumatic brain injury. 7 Google employees have reportedly quit their jobs over the lack of accountability and transparency at the search giant over its controversial China search engine effort, codenamed Project Dragonfly. General Motors recalling 1.2 million pickup trucks and sport utility vehicles worldwide due to issues with a temporary loss of power steering. Not good. The recall covers certain 2015 Chevrolet, GMC, and Cadillac pickup trucks and SUVs and includes about 102 million vehicles in the United States. If you have a moment, look at the crescent moon passing by Jupiter tonight. It is simply gorgeous. What else is up there passing in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hi, Peter.
Good evening, George. And apparently there's a lot going on up there because it's been an exciting week, and I'm very pleased to be able to share about six or seven reports with our audience tonight. First one comes from my area of the planet, up near Spokane, Washington. A gentleman called last Sunday, a very astute, very eloquent guy, very sharp, a university student, I presume. He reported that he was looking out his north-facing window over Spokane, just about a mile south of Interstate 90, and he saw what he describes as a reddish-brown, rectangular, disc-shaped object streak across the morning sky, and as it was moving from his right to left, that is, from east to west, it suddenly just abruptly dropped and descended very suddenly and kept going to the west. That's closed airspace. That's where aircraft approach Geiger Field, Spokane International Airport, so that object should not have been there. 12 hours later, a gentleman off the east coast of South Carolina and Georgia reports that at about 12 a.m., just after midnight, he saw a white light suddenly appear in the western sky from his location, and it turned distinctly orange and then blew up into a cascade of orange lights falling down to the ocean. Sounds like it might be a military ordnance, but he goes on to report that it continued to drift to the west in formation. Very interesting sighting. Unfortunately, elects to remain anonymous, so I'm not going to be able to contact him and get more facts on that one. Next one comes from down near your area, South El Monte, California. A gentleman on the 11th Tuesday of this week, 7:15 p.m., was standing outside again looking to the north, and he saw an object that at first he thought was a meteor. Suddenly, that meteor just stopped in midair, and it was now close enough to him that he could hear a screeching. He describes it as a screeching electric sound. And he called his wife out immediately. She looked at it, and while they're looking at it, it changes its course and starts moving to the northeast. Very interesting report. This morning, Augusta, Maine, a gentleman was driving to the north towards Augusta, the capital of Maine, and he saw a blue-green, disc-shaped object just drop out of the sky. The last item I'd like to mention is this strange closure of an observatory down in southeastern Arizona near the city of Gila, Arizona. FBI was involved. Nobody's talking. Not even the news media can get any kind of information about it. I'm going to try to get some more, and I'll report on it next week.
Super. Peter, thank you so much. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. Paul Stamets joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Paul Stamets back with us. Paul is the author of six books and has discovered and named numerous new species of mushrooms. Paul has received numerous awards, including Invention Ambassador for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. His work has entered into the mainstream of popular culture. Now in the new Star Trek Discovery series on CBS, the science officer is portrayed by an astromycologist by the name of Lieutenant Paul Stamets. Paul's work with mycelium is a central theme of this series. Paul funds research to save rare strains of mushrooms that dwell within the old-growth forests. He's a collaborator with numerous scientific organizations and research institutes working on testing extracts of these rare strains, and he is an expert on mushrooms. And we're going to talk to him about the power of mushrooms and what else he's been doing. Paul, welcome back to the show. You were last on with, I think, Lee Cigar about 3 years ago.
Yeah, thank you, George. A lot has happened since then.
So. Sure has. The latest research, you're doing something on saving bees, aren't you?
Yeah, that's actually been a surprising discovery. And it goes back to in 1984, I had two beehives, and I was growing some mushrooms in my garden called the garden giant mushroom. And I noticed one morning in July, when I went out to water my mushrooms, that my mushroom bed was covered with bees. And I looked really carefully, and the bees actually moved the wood chips away, and they exposed the white fuzzy mycelium.
Mm-hmm.
This is, anybody can go outside in the daytime, not right now, obviously, but you can just tip over a piece of wood on the ground and just tip it over, and you'll see this white fuzzy cobweb, and that's mycelium. So the mycelium generates mushrooms. It takes some time. But I noticed that the bees were foraging and sipping on these little droplets oozing from the mycelium. And there was a continuous convoy from morning to night from my beehives to my garden giant mushroom bed. And the bed was about 10 inches thick of wood chips. And over the course of 40 days, it shrunk to about 2 inches. And so they kind of touched it. I made a note of this. And it was published in Harrow Smith Magazine in 1988. I put it in one of my books in 1994. And I thought, they're attracted to the sweet droplets for the sugars, because mycelium produces lots of sugars. And thereupon, I sort of forgot about it. And then a friend of mine is a filmmaker, Louis Schwartzberg. We actually have a film coming out called Fantastic Fungi, coming out in a few months. He's been working on it with me for over 10 years. And Louis came to me and said, you know, Paul, I've been doing a film on pollinators, and the bees are in major crisis. I had heard of this before, but then he asked me, what can you do to help save the bees? Now, there's a sort of a bizarre series of circumstances that all strung together. I call them mycofactors in my life, that when they string them together, I came to an extraordinary discovery. And this discovery could save bees from colony collapse. Now, for listeners out there who don't know the importance of bees, I think most people do, but 30% of our food is directly dependent upon bee pollination, 70% total, directly and indirectly. The wild bees, like bumblebees and things like that, they actually confer about 80% of the pollination benefits that farmers, you know, experience come from wild bees. The European honeybee produces massive colonies and lots of honey. It's called Apis mellifera. And that was brought over in the late 1700s, and that is a Herculean bee with a big colony. The wild bees only have a few bees in their colony. They oftentimes are ground-dwelling. But unfortunately, in 1987, the Varroa mite came over to the United States. It originated from China, and the Varroa mite has decimated the bee populations. Oklahoma last year lost 84% of his beehives.
Because of these mites?
These are mites, and they leech. They attach themselves to the bees, and they inject viruses into the bees.
Oh.
And so there's 27 viruses now that have been identified that are harming bees, especially the deformed wing virus.
That can't be too healthy for people eventually, Paul.
Well, you know? we're in the age of epidemics and pandemics. And because of our transportation systems and migration, which is the way of nature, by the way, you know, all organisms do migrate. But unfortunately, diseases from Asia are decimating the bees in the United States and elsewhere throughout the world. So now all bees have these viruses. Now, even the wild bees. And what was recently discovered is that when the honeybee, who has these viruses, when they go to a flower, and they visit that flower and they get pollen on them, they transmit the virus to the pollen, and then the wild bees come to visit the same flower, and they have become infected. This is the biggest threat to worldwide food biosecurity that I know of.
Major media hasn't really even touched on this story.
Well, they have. They call it a colony collapse disorder, CDD.
But they don't know why.
Well, they didn't know why. Yeah, you're right, George. Really, in the past 2 years, in science and in Nature, very important scientific journals have zeroed in that the deformed wing virus in particular is the virus that is decimating the bees. Bees used to fly, bees only live about 30 days, except for the queen. And in the wintertime, of course, they overwinter, and so they're more dormant. Mm-hmm. But when they're active, they only live about 30 days. And typically the flight pattern of a bee is 9 days.
Hold on, Paul. Let's come back right after the break. We'll talk about that and get into these mushrooms that you've been studying next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Paul Stamets with us, of course, and Paul's latest book is Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. He's got several books out, including Growing Gourmet and Medicinal Mushrooms as well. Paul, we'll get into the mushrooms in a little bit, but let's stay on topic with the bees here for a second. This mite issue, that's kind of frightening. Is there anything that can be done about it?
Well, there's the mites are, imagine the mites are like similar in size, like if you had a large pancake on your back, and they're parasitic and they attach and they're injecting these viruses. There is a miticide, actually it's for ticks, called Ametraz, that's been approved for controlling ticks on cattle. It's been used off-label, somewhat illegally, by the honey bee producers to control the mites. And it used to be that you would dunk the beehives, they would soak them with Ametraz twice a year. In the past 7 years now, they have to soak the hives 8 times a year because the mites have developed resistance. So unfortunately, there is a entomopathogenic fungus. That's a tongue twister, but that means a fungus that attacks insects that I've been working with over a long time at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. Is doing research with me and using this fungus in order to attack the mites. But we have found that these extracts of the mycelium that I mentioned are extraordinarily powerful in reducing the deformed wing virus and other viruses. And sort of like breaking news, I'm going to tell you early, but in 2 weeks, in what is arguably said to be the most prestigious scientific journal in the world, I'm the primary author with co-authors of the USDA Virology Department, Washington State University, Dr. Steve Shepard and Brandon Hopkins and his team. And we have a paradigm-shifting breakthrough of being able to use these mycelial extracts, the extracts from the mycelium that grows on wood, that reduces these viruses thousands of times with one treatment. And for those scientists out there, if you know about p-values, if it's a p-value is a statistical measurement, if it's less than 0.05, that means that it's greater than 95% confidence that the data is good. Or our p-values are 0.0004. I mean, that's extraordinarily significant. It went through peer review. Only, I think, about 7 to 10% of the articles submitted to this journal get accepted. And so it's a high benchmark that we've passed. And this article should be out September 24th. It'll be worldwide headlines. It's really good news. And it's an extraordinary breakthrough. To date, nothing has reduced viruses in bees. There are no other articles or treatments out there. So you can fortify the immune system of the bees, because when you have these pathogenic viruses, you have malaise, you have inflammation. You're extraordinarily challenged. You can't take care of your children, your brood, in the case of the bees, as well. So hygiene is not as good. You can't defend against mites as well because you're not as strong. You're impaired. You know, nature is a numbers game.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of the equation is health or disease. And there's many coefficient variables on the first part of the equation multiplied together. These are factors in your health, and we all face this. It's the environment, pollution, food, heredity. All these factors, you know, significantly impact your state of being. And we are able to not only reduce the viruses thousands of times, but we're able to double the lifespan of bees. As I was mentioning, 9 days is when you see bees on a flower, they're the last days of their lives. And so they typically have been flying for 9 days collecting pollen, and a single bee can pollinate 1,000 flowers a day. Every almond
Jeez.
That you eat was visited by a bee. And now the flight time has been reduced to 4 days. So if you were, like in Oklahoma, 84% of the beehives died last year. Think if you're a cattle rancher or a sheep rancher, or if you had chickens, if you lost 84%.
You're done.
You're done. It's not only economically stressful, and my heart goes out to the farmers out there because I can see the challenges in agriculture are so severe right now. But it's morally depressing. I mean, you blame yourself. You wonder, WTF, you know, what is going on? And farmers tend to shoulder the responsibility. They are very, very sensitive about and very proud people. I come from a family of wheat farmers, and I know the culture well. And so this is something that's a huge challenge to worldwide food biosecurity. And you know, frankly, I think we hit a huge home run here. So this is scalable. It is ecologically rational. What I mean by that, these mushrooms that are most active are woodconks that grow on trees, hoof-shaped mushrooms. Everyone's seen them walking through the forest. They're polypore mushrooms. They don't have gills. They're not soft. They're kind of hard, and they look like they're called woodconks. And the woodconks, you know, are coming out of the mycelium that's in the tree. And so I am very happy now. I have 18 patents on this in the past year.
Sure, good for you.
And for those people concerned about patents, well, I patented this because it was my idea, and I spent literally my life working on this to sort of stumble onto this discovery. But patents are to reward the inventor so it gets to market. A patent that's not practiced is not useful to society. After 17 years, it becomes open source.
Mm-hmm.
And if I open source, I mean, I am open source this for most of the world, but my patents have issued United States, Canada, Europe, 15 countries in Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and Eurasia is soon to be issued. The rest of the world, Mesoamerica, you know, Latin America, you know, Indonesia, you know, Far East, it's all open source. But this is something that we can go to any woodlands in the world and take native woodconks off those trees, bring them in the laboratory, grow the mycelium, and then make these extracts. And only 1% of this extract is added to sugar water. All beekeepers, commercial ones, use sugar water to enhance the hive as a food source. And so those people who are beekeepers know this well, but they put 50% water, 50% sugar as a SERP. And you can just put one drop per 100 drops of this extract, and it reduces the viruses. In one case,
oh, that's 45,000
to 1.
That's huge.
With one treatment, 12 days later, George, this is a freaking home run. And there's so much bad news these days. And I'm very grateful and honored to be a messenger of good news. And this is something that speaks to the biodiversity of nature. Now, listeners out there, I've probably heard about neonicotinoids.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
They're very, very dangerous to bees. They reduce sperm quality. And Bayer and Syngenta sponsored a research study in Europe. And much to their chagrin, the research study proved that neonics are very damaging to multi-generations of bees. And now neonics have been banned in Europe. And Bayer and Syngenta sponsored this research, fully expecting that neonics would not harm the bees. And they actually tried to suppress publication, but the scientists stood firm, and they published it. And you know, now neonicotinoids are banned in Europe. We still use them in the United States. And then you get neonic drift. And so one farm using neonicotinoids, which are very powerful and effective insecticides, but they drift over, and then when they got on the flowers, you know, and they get on the pollen, and then just from air drift, the bees are adversely affected. So that's another challenge. The other one, of course, is deforestation and factory farming. There's about 2 million beehives in the United States. Over
2 million hives, and how many bees per hive? What do you think?
Well, that's a great question. Between 5,000 and 50,000.
Wow.
Yeah, these are amazing colonies.
So they outnumber us, that's for sure.
They do, and they're you know, unsung heroes. You know, this is I want to build bridges, not burn them. And saving the bees is the number one bridge issue between conservatives and liberals. So if you go to Thanksgiving, what I like to tell people, if you don't want to talk about
politics,
Trump, you know, and Hillary, talk about saving the bees.
Good point.
So it's really important that, and this is a wedge technology that I think will open up the door to the importance of biodiversity. We have not identified the compounds that are in the extracts. We think, theoretically, it upregulates the immune system, and then the immune system is able to take care of the viruses. But there's no one single molecule that we have discovered that is attributable. But now we have found 6 polypore mushrooms. These are reishi mushrooms. These are shiny woodconks, chaga, is one that grows on birch and beech trees.
By the way, what advice, Paul, to people would you give people who want to go mushroom hunting and don't know a thing about what they're finding?
Join a mycological society. There's a great nonprofit.
It's safer, isn't it?
Yeah, the North American Mycological Association has satellite organizations in practically every state in the United States, in Canada and Mexico. And if they join the society, they can look up that website for the North American Mycological Association and click on a society near them, because you'd be surrounded by experts. And it's a great cross-section of America. You have doctors, you have farmers, you have, you know, local yokels, and you have university professors all sort of unified for their passion. It's like an Easter egg hunt for adults, you know, because once people realize and they see them, so many people say to me, I had no idea there were so many in the environment, and I just didn't see them. And then when they become tuned in, they go, they're everywhere. You know, it's so important. Mycelium is the foundation of the food web of nature.
How did you get excited about mushrooms? I mean, you just didn't wake up one day and went, I want to devote my career to mushrooms.
I was always attracted to the forbidden fruit.
And biblically speaking, yeah, right?
In many ways. When I was 5 years old, my mother came out of the house one time, and I was pelting my twin brother with puffballs in Ohio, and they would explode upon impact, and they're like little missiles. And she came out of the house and said, don't throw puffballs at your twin brother. If they do, the spores will make them blind. Well, that's totally not true. But I thought to myself, great information, Mom. And I pelted my twin brother with more puffballs. But I was amazed, because when the summer rains would come, the puffballs would come up. And that was my earliest memory of mushrooms. And then my brother John went to Yale. My brother Bill went to Cornell. And I grew up in a small town called Columbiana, Ohio. We have an extensive laboratory in the basement. There were science nerds, and I was the youngest one in the family. And my father served on the USS Intrepid, the aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And when, after World War II, we got the Intrepid radio, the actual main radio for the Intrepid aircraft carrier. We got it, and it was in the basement. So we had this fully equipped laboratory, and my older brother John would never let me, quote unquote, play in the laboratory. He was a serious scientist. I was the youngest kid, but I could play on the radio. And so I was enmeshed into this very scientific family, and I idolized my older brother. And then he went to Mexico and South America and took magic mushrooms. And he came back with these extraordinary stories. And I'm 14, and this is, you know, 1969.
And you're digesting all of this, right?
And I'm just like eating it up, or trying to. And but he was, you know, again, the forbidden fruit. You're the younger brother. This, you know, you're too young, et cetera. So then my brother John came back from Yale one semester, and he had a book called Altered States of Consciousness by Charles Tart from the University of California, Davis. And he lent me this book. And he said, now, Paul, I need this book back. You know, I'm going back to Yale for my class. But, you know, I said, I really want to read this. And so my brother John said, you can have it. And my best friend Ryan, you know, we're tagging together all the time. And Ryan saw the book. And after I had skimmed it really quickly, he said, well, I'd like to borrow it. And I said, okay, you can borrow it, but you've got to give it back to me. My brother is going back to Yale. And then I see Ryan a few days later, and I said, Ryan, I need the book back. And John's going back to school. And he would avoid the conversation again and again. And after a few days, I got really upset. I go, Ryan, where's my book, my brother John's book? And Ryan said, Paul, I'm sorry. My father found it and burned it.
Ugh.
I said, your dad burned my brother's book? And I have to actually thank Ryan's dad, because that single event was like, wow, that book was so powerful with its ideas that it stimulated somebody to burn it, then I definitely found my passion. So,
all right. Well, let's get into some of the mushrooms. We'll take phone calls with you, Paul, next hour as well. In the old days, people would think magic mushrooms were bad. I guess science is beginning to say it's not as bad as everybody thought, is it?
No, there's over 8 clinical studies right now. There's a movement now to take psilocybin, the magic component in mushrooms, to make it into a Schedule II drug, which means it's valid for medical purposes by prescription. So there's clinical studies at Johns Hopkins, and Imperial College in London, and the University of California, showing that these mushrooms can be extremely good for reprogramming the brain to fight depression, PTSD, alcoholism, and obsessive compulsive behavior. With one session, under controlled in therapeutic settings, with professionals, but it's been stated by some of the FDA scientists and regulators, they've never seen a drug that's so safe, so powerful. And, you know, it's not a really good profit incentive for the pharmaceutical industry because they like to sell prescriptions over and over again. So to have the substance that could change your life and improve it dramatically from one experience is quite extraordinary. There's a number of studies that have come out, and one of the ones from the Human Health Science, Health Sciences, HHS, was particularly interesting, where they surveyed 480,000 convicts and on a personal survey, and they found that those convicts who reported on their drug use, who had taken psilocybin mushrooms, had almost an 18 to 20% reduction in criminal behavior, larceny, burglary, and violent crime. Now, association is not causation, but it can be. So this is a very large data set. And so this is indicative of the people who have used these mushrooms. And I know people have used them once. They said, I'll never use them again. But they found that these were pivotal in improving their life. And the re-remembering of the experience in the clinical studies have found to have a significant improvement in their attitude, their mental health, and their behavior. They're better citizens. They're better people. And these are not substances of abuse. Anybody out there who's ingested these mushrooms know exactly what I'm saying, because once you take them and you see them the next day or a few days later, you go, no way, I'm not going to touch those. They're way too powerful. But it can significantly improve mental health on multiple levels. It helps to remap the brain with neurological pathways that can overcome sort of entrenched habitual behavior, especially fear and depression. And other forms of trauma. So this is extraordinary. And people can look up this through PubMed, et cetera. There's about a dozen studies, a very large study being planned, multi-country study being planned this next year, with hundreds and hundreds of patients. But, you know, Johns Hopkins work with Dr. Roland Griffiths is particularly interesting. And it's something that these are medicines for the soul.
All right, we're going to come back and talk more about this, Paul, and we'll take calls with you, too, on Coast to Coast AM.